Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We are in the midst of some very serious challenges, I believe, to the kingdom, not least the assault that is underway from, well, it seems pretty much the entire world on the Holy Land, the nation and people of Israel specifically. They were murderously attacked, of course, as you know, on October 7th of last year. They have been defending themselves rather impressively, I think it's fair to say, ever since, specifically against Hamas, the perpetrators of that attack, but also against other Iranian proxies, including Hezbollah in the north of the country. A man who has studied all this closely, has been to Israel repeatedly in the interval since October 7th, and of course many times prior to that, and who we turn to, especially on matters involving the military character of what's going on at the moment in Gaza and beyond, is our friend Richard Kemp. He is a retired colonel in the British military. He served as the commanding officer of its forces in Afghanistan, which is particularly relevant to today's topic, as I see it. We've just been talking about him becoming a senior fellow of our Center for Security Policy, which we would be very honored to have him be. He is a remarkable and extraordinarily clear-thinking expert on national security writ large, especially that involved in places like the Middle East. Colonel Kemp, it is a privilege to have you with us, sir. Welcome back. Can you hear me, Richard?
Sorry, you froze, Frank, after you introduced me.
I was just saying it's a privilege to have you with us, Colonel. Welcome back.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be with you, and thank you for your kind words.
Well, they're heartfelt and I think well-deserved. Let me start by asking you, if I may, sir, about the nature of the war that is underway in Gaza. You have in the past described the Israeli military's attention to avoiding civilian casualties as exemplary. I'm not sure if that's exactly the word you used, but I think it characterizes it. And yet we are now watching a very considerable thrash taking place over whether Israel purposefully attacked seven humanitarian aid workers associated with the World Central Kitchen. What do we know about what happened there, and does that bespeak an indifference to civilian casualties on the part of the Israel Defense Forces?
Well, the first thing I'd say, Frank, is that I've spent pretty much all of the last 6+ months inside Israel since the 9th of October. And in that time, I've been into the Gaza Strip on several occasions during the land war. And I've observed close up exactly what the IDF is doing there in various different aspects. And I've been deeply impressed by the tactical handling, by the professionalism with which they have fought an enemy that's in among the civilian population, and also operating in a very, very extensive below ground tunnel network, bigger even than the underground system here in the UK, probably about twice the size of it, in fact. So deeply professional organization, which has achieved some astonishing results in killing Hamas terrorists, capturing Hamas terrorists in large numbers as well, while trying to minimize deaths of innocent civilians. And I was present in a command group meeting inside Gaza by three IDF generals who were discussing future operations. And in that hour-long meeting, they took about 15 to 20 minutes discussing how they would deal with a specific target that they had to take out that was very close to a school that was being used to house refugees. And that, I think, to me, that is a graphic illustration of the care they're taking in this. They have, I won't go into detail now, I'm sure you're viewers and listeners know a lot about it, but they've taken the most sophisticated measures to minimize civilian casualties. Of course, you know, all of our minds are occupied at the moment with the tragic incident you mentioned, the deaths of seven aid workers in the World Central Kitchen. That was indeed a terrible tragedy. And the IDF have now issued a report on the outcome of their investigation that they immediately conducted into it. And that report reveals that the incident occurred as a result of bad coordination among IDF commanders, wrong decisions in ordering a strike in the circumstances. So they've basically admitted culpability for it. And as I understand it, they've also dismissed a number of senior commanders who were involved and reprimanded others, including the commander of Southern Command, one of the most senior generals in the IDF. So they clearly take it very seriously. But what it comes down to is, unfortunately, a very tragic mistake. And these sort of mistakes happen in war, every armed force involved, including the US, the British and the Israeli, they make mistakes like this. Just think back to August 2021 when President Biden ordered the disastrous withdrawal from Afghanistan. As that withdrawal was taking place, a US drone strike was launched against what was thought to be a Taliban terrorist cell. And that strike killed an aid worker and 9 members of his family, including 7 children. Nobody suggested that that was deliberate. It wasn't deliberate. It was a tragic mistake. And it was actually not totally dissimilar from this incident because it involved the misidentification of a vehicle, as this incident did as well. So these things happen. They're terrible, but they will always happen in the situation of such confusion, chaos, fear, danger as occur in war.
And at night, no less, in this case.
Absolutely.
And Colonel, I think that's so well said. And the argument that we've heard is, well, you know, 3 different vehicles in this instance were attacked separately and after, you know, a pause, which resulted in individuals traveling in them scattering around to try to get into one of the other vehicles. And I guess the report has definitively concluded that that was simply a mistake. This was not a purposeful effort to harm these humanitarian workers.
Yeah, the commanders who were involved in ordering this strike believed that the vehicles contained armed Hamas terrorists, and therefore they were a legitimate target for attack. They did not think they contained aid workers. Now, that shouldn't have happened. It should not have happened. And the IDF have accepted it shouldn't have happened. It was due to poor coordination. And they've already put in place a mechanism to improve that in the future. The fact that it was, a lot of people have been accusing Israel of war crimes, including perhaps understandably the families of the victims. But this is not a war crime, at least as far as I can see it on the surface from what the IDF have produced. This is not a war crime. It's a tragic error. If they had intended to kill these aid workers, which would be unimaginable for the IDF, many other armies in the Middle East might decide to do so, but not the IDF. If they'd intended to kill them, that would have been a war crime. But according to the IDF report, that was certainly not the intention.
Richard Kemp is our guest. Retired colonel in the British military. And I wanted to just ask you, sir, what is being drawn from all of this and endless reports that famine is now happening in Gaza and that therefore more humanitarian assistance is required. And we were told in the immediate aftermath of this incident that some of these humanitarian aid groups were saying they won't go back into operation there unless they're satisfied that it is safe. And I'm going to ask you on the other side of a short break to respond to all of that. But I felt moved to write a commentary, which is available at centerforsecuritypolicy.org, our Secure Freedom Minute, to just put everybody on notice. Gaza is not safe. It is an active war zone, and it must be treated as such. We'll be right back with more. Stay tuned. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Over the weekend, Israel withdrew most of its combat forces from southern Gaza in the wake of Joe Biden's threats to cut back the U.S. supply of weapons vital to the defense of the Jewish state and his aggressive efforts to bring down the government of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Has the president accomplished his evident goal of saving Hamas? If so, Biden's betrayal of the Jewish state is all the more outrageous in light of mounting evidence that undermines his latest pretexts for doing so. First, it appears Hamas engineered the incident in which Israel's military unintentionally killed 7 aid workers. And second, Israel's apparent elimination of a top Iranian commander in Damascus recently was fully justified as he reportedly personally orchestrated Hamas's murderous October 7th invasion. A new poll confirms that American voters overwhelmingly support Israel. So should Joe Biden. This is Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and we're joined once again, I'm very happy to say, by Richard Kemp, a retired British Army colonel, a man with great experience in the nasty business of warfare in urban areas, notably during his time as the commanding officer of British forces in Afghanistan. And Colonel, I wanted to ask you, you've talked with us in the past about the extent to which the IDF is not only obviously going to great lengths to try to minimize civilian casualties, but their record of doing so in Gaza, arguably one of the hardest places to do that imaginable, not least because it's densely populated, of course, but also because the Hamas terrorists insist on interposing wherever they can their civilians in harm's way. What is the record here, sir, just to be?
Well, you rightly say Hamas interpose the civilians. They do more than that. They actually, their strategy is intended to get the IDF to kill as many of their civilians as possible in order to bring about exactly what we're seeing now, the condemnation of the world, the isolation of Israel, and even in their hope, the separation of Israel from the United States. But the reality is that Israel, in all its previous conflicts in response to Hamas aggression from Gaza, has achieved probably the world's lowest civilian to military casualty ratio or death ratio of any conflict. And in this conflict, my understanding is that, and it's very hard during a conflict to actually ascertain exact details, but from the figures as I've seen them, I believe that the IDF have achieved a one-to-one civilian to military death ratio. In other words, one civilian has been killed for every combatant killed. That sounds terrible. It does sound awful because obviously the target is the terrorists, not the civilians. But I go back to Hamas's way of operating with human shields. In war generally, the United Nations issued a report a few years ago suggesting that in war since the Second World War, particularly urban conflict, the ratio is 9 civilians to every 1 combatant killed. And in Afghanistan and Iraq, the ratios were 3 civilians killed for every combatant and 5 civilians killed for every combatant. So as we can see, despite
those involved US forces, let me hasten to add.
And those ratios are not to do with Afghan forces. They're US and coalition forces, including Britain, fighting against insurgents. So as we can see from that, despite the extraordinary conditions the IDF is fighting in, they've achieved a far better civilian to military death ratio than pretty much any other army that I'm aware of.
Yeah, and yet at the moment, as you know, sir, both in your country and here, we're hearing official as well as popular criticism on a very high level. Talk a little bit about what is happening in the UK at the moment among former and serving government officials in this regard.
Well, this latest incident terrible though it is, has triggered an even worse outburst of anti-Israel feeling in the establishment and in the population than was going on before. And it was already very bad, even though I would guess that the majority of British people, ordinary, decent British people, support Israel and what it's trying to do here, because they know that these people are our enemies as much as they are Israel's enemies. But we had a petition, I think, of 600 prominent lawyers recently who accused Israel, in Britain this is, accused Israel of genocide and told the government that they should stop supplying arms to Israel. We had some civil servants working for the government in the departments that deal with arms exports, threatening to strike if the arms exports to Israel are not stopped. These are completely unjustified. They're based on complete false information and a misreading of the law and of the judgment, for example, of the International Court of Justice.
Right. Unfortunately, it's even worse here at the moment, I would argue. There's some of that going on among those civil servants and former, officials. But the Biden team itself, the president and the secretary of state have in just the past day or so laid down that unless Israel changes its conduct in the war in Gaza, American policy towards Israel will change. And the implication, I believe, and again, I've treated this in a commentary today at centerforsecuritypolicy.org, is that unless Israel allows Hamas to survive, in fact, winds up saving it, that the United States is going to cut off the resupply of arms needed to defeat Hamas. I have to say, as a great admirer of Israel and as a person, as you say so well, convinced that they are fighting our enemies too, this prospect is just absolutely stomach churning, and I believe an abomination. Your thoughts, sir, and what would your advice be to the United States government at this moment?
I think some of the things we've heard from the Biden administration in recent days and previous to that, but particularly in recent days, has been absolutely outrageous. Particularly, I think, when Secretary of State Blinken compared Israel to Hamas. That was an abomination, to say the very least, when you've got a democratic army, Israel, which is doing everything it can to minimize civilian casualties against an enemy that is doing everything it can as an instrument of policy to commit war crimes. There's no comparison. And it's that I believe that that the Secretary of State should apologize for those very, very unfortunate, well, worse than unfortunate words. And unfortunately, that what the US seems to be trying to do in what I think amounts to something close to a betrayal of one of its close allies is to replicate the disaster of Afghanistan. Stop, you know, the US withdrew from Afghanistan in 2021 under Biden. And the outcome of that was the Taliban took control again. The Taliban had been quite severely written down. They rose up and took control again. Apart from the oppression of the Afghan people, including particularly women, but also many other people, murdered, tortured, raped under Taliban, repressed obviously under Taliban rule. Apart from that, Afghanistan again has become a base for jihadist attack against other countries. And we saw an example of that recently with Islamic State in Afghanistan launching, according to the US intelligence service, launching an attack in Russia that killed a huge number of people in Moscow. They've attempted similar attacks in the UK, haven't actually come off, but they've tried it.
Not for want of trying.
And therefore, what they're asking is the same thing for Israel. So let Hamas, you know, surrender to Hamas, withdraw the IDF, let Hamas take control of Gaza again. You'll see the same thing. You'll see repression as in Afghanistan, and you'll see terrorist attacks being launched again against Israel. This is going to be the consequence if they continue down this irresponsible route.
Well, I second everything you've said, sir, especially I think of this as really Afghanistan 2.0 that's in prospect now. But I would go farther, because I really fear that the people that are now at war with Israel in various stages of warfare, including Iran, will be so emboldened by this threat of cutting off the Israeli military from resupply that you may well see them believing they can now go for it against Israel proper, and as they're fond of saying, drive the Jews from the river to the sea. We will be culpable for helping bring about that condition. I think we've been culpable, I believe, from the inception of this administration for its hostility towards Benjamin Netanyahu, especially, but I think towards the state of Israel for much of what's happened to date. But I do fear that there's something far worse in the offing than Afghanistan 2.0, perhaps, if this this policy approach is not formally and immediately repudiated. Colonel Kemp, thank you for your time today. I can't tell you how much I appreciate your insights. I want to have you back and talk a little bit about that port the United States is interested in building in Gaza, but that'd be for another day. God bless you, my friend. Keep up the great
work. Thank you, Frank.
Talk to you soon. We'll be right back with more right after this.
Night after night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to our friend and colleague and co-host for this very important weekly feature of Securing America, Dee Dee Laugesen. She is not only the executive director of our Save the Persecuted Christians initiative, but also the executive secretary of our Committee on the Present Danger China. She's featured each week in the webinars that we do in connection with the CPDC. And if you are not signed up for those webinars, folks, I urge you to do so at presentdangerchina.org. They're just stupendously important programs. We'll be talking a little bit more about it with Gordon Chang shortly, but I do want you to know one of the highlights of those programs, as well as this one, is Dee Dee Laugesen does a cameo appearance. Dee Dee, welcome, and tell us about your guest and what we're going to be talking about in this important segment.
Hi, Frank. So as you know, Save the Persecuted Christians is working to counter the historic persecution of Christians around the world. 360 million heavily persecuted Christians really wake up every single day and don't know if they'll make it to the end of the day because of their love for Jesus. And we work with a whole huge group of activists on many different countries. And one of those is Armenia. Last September, in one day, we saw the fall of Nagorno-Karabakh after a 10-month blockade. And so we have Matthias Pertula here with us. They're standing up a new coalition. He is the director of Save Armenia, a new Judeo-Christian coalition for Armenia. Matthias, tell us a little bit, what happened to Nagorno-Karabakh and why should Americans, and especially American Christians, care?
Sure. Sure. Thanks so much for having me on, and just a pleasure to be with you both. And I mean, Armenia has been a point of concern for me for some time throughout my career with working on international religious freedom issues, but it really heated up for Armenia in 2020 with the initial invasion from Azerbaijan. That full frontal assault by the Azeris in Nagorno-Karabakh consisted of carpet bombing, targeting of civilians, so on and so forth, the works of just absolute atrocities against the Armenian Christians. The tensions since 2020 leveled off for some time, but really sped back up again in 2023, and really at the end of 2022, when the blockade was launched by the Azeri government. And really, they withheld all valuable humanitarian aid that they were receiving regularly in Nagorno-Karabakh. Food, medicine, gas, you name it, anything that they needed to live on was cut off. This did not receive a lot of global attention. However, some reports were making out of the region. They even cut off Wi-Fi access to internet, so information was very hard to get from this place. As the Azeris came into Nagorno-Karabakh, they commenced, in addition to the blockade, what many are calling essentially an intent on genocide, or genocide completely of that area. And this consisted of targeting of civilians, taking POWs, you name it, and just horrible treatment of these people. And I want to just remind folks, Nagorno-Karabakh in Armenia is home to Armenian Christians for over millennia, since the first centuries after Christ. Armenia was the first country to actually embrace Christianity officially in 300 or so AD. Several apostles did lots of work there. They brought the gospel to the Armenians to the point that they eventually in 300 or so accepted Christianity officially as a country, as their own religion. So the Armenian and the religious history of Christianity really has a home in Armenia and in this region. And even predating Christendom's arrival in Armenia, you're looking at Mount Ararat, the bastion mountain, essentially, where Noah's Ark landed, and it's there. So even predating Christian days into the Judeo history, we see the biblical presence in this region. So when you hear the Azeri government, the Aliyev regime, say that this has nothing to do with Christianity, they have no right to this land, there is no history or so on and so forth for the Armenian or Christians in this region, it's an outright lie, it's Azeri propaganda, and it's their way of just dehumanizing and creating more of a public rhetoric to justify their heinous human rights violations in this whole region. And the reason why we're standing up Save Armenia, yeah, go ahead, Dee.
Political tension around Armenia and Nagorno-Karabakh now has fallen. It is part of Azerbaijan. We know that Azerbaijan has genocidal intentions. For anybody left there who may be Armenian, we've heard about concentration camps even being stood up in plans for what they were intending for the people of Nagorno-Karabakh. But even more so, we have Turkey involved, Russia, Azerbaijan, Iran, all of these geopolitical tensions. What is the concern for Armenia itself now that Nagorno-Karabakh has fallen? And tell us about the people of the Armenians of Nagorno-Karabakh. What's their status now?
So in terms of the 120,000 Armenians that were essentially pushed off of their lands in Nagorno-Karabakh, there's only a very small population that remained behind. It's less than 100 or so in Nagorno-Karabakh. The rest, about 120,000 or so, were relocated to Armenia, and they have been dispersed throughout the country. And the government of Armenia is essentially sponsoring their stay there in hotels, apartments. Many of them had family in Armenia, so they were able to get housing. So most of that, the Armenian government has done a very good job of trying to relocate and bring them the support that they need to carry on with their lives. In terms of the ongoing threats to Armenia, in terms of geopolitics, this is a consistent thing with the Azeri government. There will be a moment or a period of aggression, violence, an escalation of tensions, and then they'll get something from that, a piece of land, Nagorno-Karabakh, maybe another enclave or an Armenian village or so on. Then there'll be a moment of peace, and then the escalation begins again. So it's this tug of war kind of thing that continues to happen with the Azeri government. But make no mistake, the Azeri government is 100% committed to this policy. Aliyev has made it very clear throughout many public comments that Armenians do not belong in the region. This, and he's gone even as far as to say that Armenia proper is actually historically Azeri land, which is a complete lie, absolutely. So there's a consistent, you see the rhetoric translating into policy, and you see that being carried out systematically in the region.
Trying to create a passage, the ancient Belt and Silk Road went through Armenia into Turkey. And there are a lot of people talking about how Azerbaijan is already calling Armenia West Azerbaijan, and that they do intend to take the entire country and recreate that road through to Turkey. Is the Western world just going to let this happen?
We're told no, but we saw that also happen with Nagorno-Karabakh. We had the State Department go on record saying that Nagorno-Karabakh is a red line for us. We will not tolerate it. And literally weeks later, the Azeris still launched the attack and took it over. So there's a lot of good sounding rhetoric that you're hearing from the West and from the United States. But is there any hard policy to actually back that up, to bring some sort of restrainment on the Azeris? No, we haven't seen that. We think that there needs to be an absolute international initiative led by the West that puts sanctions or some form of hard policy apparatus around Azerbaijan to restrain it so that they will be kept over the border.
We just have a minute and a half. Go ahead, Frank.
Just a quick point. I'm so struck by the discrepancy between the attention that this issue is receiving and that we were discussing with Colonel Richard Kemp in the previous segment involving Gaza. I mean, the world is intensely engaged in trying to save terrorists in the latter case, but seemingly indifferent to the kind of terrorism that's being perpetrated against Armenia and, of course, has now been meted out to Nagorno-Karabakh. Your thoughts?
Well, I would say that that's probably the case right now. That seems to be the policy of it. And that's part of the reason why Save Armenia is being stood up. We want to be on the opposite end of that spectrum. This issue needs to be made the main issue. Now, when 2023 happened, when the invasion in Nagorno-Karabakh happened, that also happened in the context of what was going on in Israel at the time. So a lot of that grabbed the attention of the world, naturally, and it rightfully so. But does not mean that Armenia doesn't deserve the attention as well. And it needs to be told. The story needs to be told. And we believe Save Armenia, the church, which is a big part of our mission here, especially the evangelical church world in the United States, can be a voice for the voiceless of the Armenians and really be the conduit that brings the issue to the forefront. And we believe that with that kind of critical mass, we can create good amount of political and social pressure that will support Armenia and good policy towards Armenia.
How can people find you, Matthias?
So our website will be launched in about 10 days or so. Actually, correct myself here, in about 6 days, savearmenia.us. We welcome all of you to come visit us there. All of our research, our writing, ways to contact, ways to get engaged, all of that will be listed on our website.
Terrific. Didi, thank you so much for doing such a marvelous job with this interview. And Matthias, thank you for your leadership in this space. I have a sneaking suspicion that the discrepancy may have something to do with that it's Christians that are being victimized here as opposed to Muslims in Gaza. We'll be monitoring this closely and look forward very much to helping with your project.
I think you're very right on that point, Frank. Yeah.
We have to let it go at that. Thank you, Matthias. Thank you, Didi. Come back next week.
Thank you.
God bless you.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Over the weekend, Israel withdrew most of its combat forces from southern Gaza in the wake of Joe Biden's threats to cut back the U.S. supply of weapons vital to the defense of the Jewish state and his aggressive efforts to bring down the government of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Has the president accomplished his evident goal of saving Hamas? If so, Biden's betrayal of the Jewish state is all the more outrageous in light of mounting evidence that undermines his latest pretexts for doing so. First, it appears Hamas engineered the incident in which Israel's military unintentionally killed 7 aid workers. And second, Israel's apparent elimination of a top Iranian commander in Damascus recently was fully justified as he reportedly personally orchestrated Hamas's murderous October 7th invasion. A new poll confirms that American voters overwhelmingly support Israel. So should Joe Biden. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back, and this is one of the highlights of my week. We had the chance to visit just about every one of them with the great Gordon Chang. Gordon is a man of many parts. He has lived in China. He's worked there. He understands it intimately. He is based in the United States now, and he spends most of his waking hours, I think, warning about what he knows of China. He is the author, among other things, of The Coming Collapse of China. He is also of counsel to us in our Committee on the Present Danger, China, and in so many other respects, as well as, of course, on this program. You can follow all of his great work at Gordon G. Chang on Twitter, X, as you wish. Gordon, it's so good to have you back. Thank you for joining us once again.
Well, thank you, Frank. And this is the highlight of my week, too.
You're very kind. Let me start by asking you about the reprise of engagement, I think it's fair to say. It was the kind of leitmotif of this week. We had President Biden on the phone with the dictator of China, Xi Jinping, for half an hour, I think, maybe longer. What did you make of it and the trip thereafter of Janet Yellen, the Treasury Secretary, to Beijing for what seems to be yet another of the kowtowing excursions of this administration to China?
Well, this administration wants to tell the American people that it is managing relations with China, but clearly it's not. Because after Tuesday's phone call between Biden and Xi Jinping, the Chinese engaged in that very provocative naval and air exercise around Taiwan. 30 planes and 9 ships intruding into Taiwan's water and airspace. And that shows us that deterrence is breaking down. You know, everyone would like for us to have friendly relations with the People's Republic. But the point is, the People's Republic doesn't want friendly relations with us. And we should stop talking and start to impose costs, because that's the only way that we're going to get out of this without a war.
And when you talk about cost, Gordon, I'm pretty sure that's not on Janet Yellen's agenda. In fact, what she seems to be enthusing about is trying to help the Chinese build up their so-called green energy manufacturing base so as to enable us to become more dependent upon a very dubious supply chain for something as important as energy security. Am I missing something?
Well, the point here is that I don't know what Janet Yellen can accomplish now that she didn't accomplish in July of last year when she went. It's not her job to try to get China to put itself on a sustainable economic basis. It's her job to protect the United States of America. You know, and she's going to go over there and she's going to talk about, for instance, trying to get China to move to a consumption-based economy, so it doesn't try to export its way out of problems. And yeah, that's great advice. The Chinese leaders have heard that for decades, and they have for decades ignored it. So I think that it's time that we understand that China calculates its interests differently. They see the world in starkly different terms. We've got to start defending ourselves. And the last thing that Janet Yellen should be doing is taking time out, spending money, going to a country that positively hates us.
Yeah, and seeks our destruction, to be perfectly clear about it. Gordon, the interesting thing to me is that I really can't think of a Treasury Secretary, certainly in recent years, who has protecting America as the mission of their post. It always seems as though they're consumed with figuring out how to encourage investment in our country, including from places like communist China, or encourage investment from Wall Street and trillions from unsuspecting Americans. It seems as though it's always about something other than protecting America, except to the extent that you can sort of rationalize all of this in some abstract way as helpful to the economy. But it really isn't so much. And what do we do about that? Because it seems as though this is a place where typically we've found captured elites running the Treasury Department.
Look, our elites have been captured by China. And we got to be clear about this. This is not just Biden. It's not just the Democratic Party. It's also the Republicans as well. And actually, some of the elites who propagate Communist Party narratives with great determination are actually conservative Republicans. And this is a problem across our political spectrum. I'm not saying conservative Republicans like communists, but they do have certain common aims. So, for instance, we have a lot of people in the Republican Party right now who believe in absolutely free trade, who believe that there should be no national security considerations when it comes to our policies with China. And that's absolutely wrong. So we've got a problem, and we've got to admit that it cuts across entire elite sections of our country. So at this point, we must do something about it. We American people need to take back our country.
Amen. And I really hope, Gordon, that that's kind of a defining issue in this upcoming election season, because as you know better than just about anybody, if we get this wrong, we may well not survive the next 4 years, literally, in light of what the Chinese are up to. But I'm mindful back when I was a kid and had the privilege of serving for a time in the Reagan administration, there was an offer made to the American people of a real course correction vis-a-vis what was at that time our greatest existential threat. And of course, the Soviet Union. And Reagan went to the American people in 1980 and said, look, I'm not interested in appeasing these people with detente or even containing them. I believe we need to roll them back. And by God, he got a mandate for doing that. I hope that that's one of the things that we'll be hearing out of, presumably the Trump campaign. Though we're told, Gordon, I wanted to get your reaction to this. We're told by some that actually the Chinese Communist Party wants Trump to be elected president rather than Joe Biden reelected. What's your thought on that?
Yeah, I actually don't think that's the case. I think the Chinese want
Gordon,
Biden.
Hold on. I'm sorry, I'm out of time. Let me just take a short break and I'll ask you to respond to that a little bit more fulsomely. Gordon Chang is in the house, the author of The Coming Collapse of China. Follow him as I do at Gordon G. Chang and into the next block. We'll be right back. We're back, and Gordon Chang is still with us, I'm very pleased to say, because I put a question to him that he didn't get a chance to properly answer. And Gordon, that question was basically this. We're told by some that the Chinese Communist Party is really rooting for Donald Trump to be reelected, not
a guy that many of us think is their favorite, namely Joe Biden. What's your take on that, sir?
Yeah, I think that the Communist Party wants Biden. And, you know, we're going to see a number of things in this campaign that will confirm that. If we go back to 2020, which is a guide to what they will do in 2024, clearly the Communist Party was favoring Joe Biden over Bernie Sanders in the Democratic primaries, and they favored Biden over Trump in the general election. We have indication of what Chinese dirty tricks during the general election campaign, and they were all favoring Biden. Also, we know that Act Blue, which is the Democratic Party website, China was funneling a lot of cash from actually foreign sources into the Democratic Party through that website. This time,
I checked, that would not be legal, I don't think, is it?
Clearly not legal, but that's not going to stop the Chinese. This time, you know, a lot of people do argue and they say, well, look, Trump is going to take down NATO and China would certainly like that. I actually don't think that Trump is going to withdraw from NATO. I think that's just scaremongering. The other thing, though, it's fundamental, and that is the Chinese can deal with a hostile American president, but they can't deal with an unpredictable one. And Trump was unpredictable. And that, I think, drives the people in Beijing as well as the people in Moscow crazy. So my sense is that they very much want Biden to win.
I think you're absolutely right. Gordon, we've got a limited amount of time. I want to do kind of a lightning round with you to just touch on a couple of different things that are really important and we need to catch up on in terms of your thinking. You mentioned increased bellicosity, shall we say, on the part of the Chinese Communist Party vis-a-vis Taiwan. They're also ratcheting up rather aggressively the pressure on the Philippines. What's in the offing there? I'm hearing Beijing is warning that this could start World War III.
Yeah. If there's going to be a flashpoint with China this year, it probably will be the Philippines. I think that Xi Jinping has decided that Taiwan is too hard a military target and it would be too unpopular inside China. We have seen some very dangerous belligerent activity on the part of the Chinese in the Philippines, especially at Second Thomas Shoal. We know that deterrence is breaking down. This is dangerous beyond belief.
What are our responsibilities in the event that even, as some have said, a single Filipino sailor is killed in the course of all of this?
Article 4 of our mutual defense treaty with the Philippines requires us to come to its aid. Twice last month, on the 5th and the 29th, the State Department issued written warnings that the United States was prepared to use force against China to discharge our obligations pursuant to that provision. That's about like the 7th or 8th written warning from the State Department during the Biden administration. Biden, on October 25 of last year, issued an oral warning to China of the same. The Chinese are just ignoring it, and that means deterrence, you know, is failed.
Yeah. Do you think that he brought that up in his conversation with Xi this week?
The White House readout does say that they talked about the Philippines, and I wouldn't be surprised because, as you say, if World War III starts, it's probably going to start at Scarborough Shoal, Second Thomas Shoal, Whitsun Reef.
Well, South China Sea. Gordon, another issue that, of course, is very vexing to both of us, going back to that engagement bit and the Treasury Secretary and her interest in keeping Wall Street pumping money into China, propping up the Chinese Communist Party, in fact, is that you had a piece in The Hill, as I recall, recently talking about how even Wall Street now recognizes that China is, as you put it, uninvestable. There seems to be a disconnect here. What's going on, do you think?
Well, Goldman Sachs, which was the cheerleader for Chinese investment into China, has now turned its position. The chief investment officer of the wealth management division said no one should invest in China. She's obviously right. You know, there are voices on Wall Street like Ray Dalio saying this is a great time to put money into the Chinese state. But I don't think people are going to follow because Xi Jinping has made it very clear that although he'll say nice words, he's still pressuring foreign business in a way which is quite scary.
We'll be watching this closely with your help, my friend. Let me ask you about one last thing. You also have written recently at the Daily Caller about Joe Biden having plenty of authority right now to unplug TikTok, as you put it. There's a bill that's moving, we think, through Congress. Biden says he'll sign it if it comes to his desk. Where does the truth lie here? Is that bill necessary? And is the president really interested in unplugging TikTok or actually not?
Yeah, only the president can tell you how interested he is. My sense is he's not. He does have the authority under the International Emergency Economic Powers Act. He has the authority under the Trading with the Enemy Act of 1917 because we are in a technical state of war with China. The Korean War did not end with a peace treaty. It ended with an armistice. President Truman used the Trading with the Enemy Act against China. And also we know that China's used TikTok to foment violence on our streets. That's an act of war. He can confiscate it pursuant to existing federal forfeiture statutes. And that, by the way, without compensation. So, yes, I think he should do those things because China's been using TikTok in a way to subvert the United States and to destroy our republic.
Big time. You know, Gordon, we had a fascinating webinar from our Committee on the Present Danger of China just yesterday on this subject. And one of our speakers, Connie Elliott, addressed very directly the role that TikTok is being applied to for the purposes that you've just described, subverting us, fomenting amongst our young people uncertainties about, you know, who they are, let alone who they stand with, our country or China. And as you say, we've seen the weaponization of this very directly in terms of moving pro-Hamas supporters into our streets and the like. It is something that I hope the president will heed your admonition to terminate, as it is a weapon of war against our country, unrestricted cultural warfare in this case. Gordon, we'll let you go. Thank you for your time today, my friend. Thank you for all you do. Come back to us soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same. Check out centerforsecuritypolicy.org on your way out the door. And come back. Until then, go forth and multiply.